So there was a story I read this week about a gentleman. He came into kind of a small town, kind of like ours, and there was a mom and pop store there. So he went inside and he asked the gentleman, "Well, do you guys sell any salt?" And the owner's, "Well, do we sell salt? Come here, let me show you." And so they went to the aisle. And in the aisle, they had all sorts of salts imaginable, right? Iodine salt, Morton salt, kosher salt, sea salt, rock salt, seasoning salt, garlic salt, Epsom salt, all sorts of salts were right there on the shelf. And the gentleman said, "Well, goodness, you look at all these salts." And he said, the owner said, "You have seen nothing yet." And so he took him to the back room. And the back room, he's got shelves and wall-to-wall salts of all different kinds ready to go back on the shelves to be able to be sold. And the gentleman's like, that is a lot of salt. Goodness, you must do pretty well. And he's like, wait a second. And they went down to the basement, and the basement was twice the size of the store upstairs. And there were cartons, and there were bins and boxes and everything full of these different kinds of salt. And the gentleman was like, "Well, sir, you certainly do sell a lot of salt, don't you?" And the owner sighed and said, "You know what, that's the problem. I actually don't sell very much salt. But you know who does? The guy that travels around to sell the salt to the stores, he sells salt." That really has nothing to do with the sermon. But it starts maybe thinking about salt and how valuable salt is, I guess. Most of us probably, we just get so used to salt being around. But if you think about it, we use salt all the time in everything. I use a ton of salt in my food. But, you know, we use it in our softeners and everything. Salt is everywhere. It's such an important part of our lives. And in fact, I probably should have known this. This is kind of one of these today years old kind of a thing. Salt is essential for our blood pressure and keeping our fluids balanced and stuff. I should have known that. I don't know why that was new information for a 38-year-old, but I knew, you know, if you had too much salt, you couldn't eat a lot, you know, salt and stuff. But that, it's an essential part of our bodies, which again, I feel a little, I shouldn't say, share things that I'm embarrassed by, but maybe it makes me feel better. I don't know. All right, so we are in part two of our Culture of a Kingdom, the study of the Sermon on the Mount from Matthew 5. We're going to cover about Matthew 5 for the next couple months, I guess, leading into Advent. And I guess the idea behind it and what we're looking at is what is this culture that Jesus is trying to bring into this world look like? What is this kingdom culture going to be? Or what should it be? Especially for those of us that are followers of Jesus. And we talked about last week how Jesus kind of drew in his closest followers, his disciples, last week before he went into the Beatitudes. And he drew them in and said, this is really for you. It's for everybody that wants to follow me, but this is really for those that have already chosen to follow me, to look like this. And again, we looked at the Beatitudes last week. I don't know if anybody went home and read it. Congratulations, like I kind of suggested, are the poor in spirit or the meek and those kind of things. Because I think it does help a little bit understand what Jesus is trying to get across. These are, you know, wonderful blessings, Beatitudes, these congratulations for the things that we're choosing to do. But really the Beatitudes, and I'm not going to critique Jesus because that, you know, thunders and, you know, lightning bolts come down. But no, just looking at Jesus' words, the Beatitudes aren't really very practical, right? They're more foundational kinds of things. They're more attitude and conceptual kind of things. Be humble, be merciful, be kind, be peaceful, right? Be single-minded on God and these things. And so Jesus needs to expand and just, unlike probably several of my sermons, Jesus' sermon, you know, has a logical flow to it. And so what he's doing after the Beatitudes here is he's transitioning. And even last week, we kind of saw the beginning of that transition into how does this look in day-to-day life. And that's going to be more next week than this week. Because here he's going to kind of do broad strokes again. He's saying, these are the attitudes that I want you to have in the Beatitudes, which makes sense. These are kind of the big ideas behind it when we look at Matthew 5, 13 through 16. And we'll talk more about that in just a little bit as well. But before we jump in, just again, this is kind of a transitional kind of thing. And in fact, Jesus' point to his sermon, I found this quote. I think this is just fabulous. It's from a gentleman named Dr. James Stewart, and he's a British preacher, but we won't hold that against him. But he says this. I need to stop doing these side notes, or we're not going to get anywhere. This is what he says. He says, "The greatest threat to Christianity is not communism, it's not atheism, it's not materialism, it's not humanism. The greatest threat to Christianity is Christians trying to sneak into heaven incognito without ever sharing their faith, without ever living the Christian life, without ever becoming involved in the most significant work God is doing on planet Earth." And that is Jesus' point to the sermon. How do we live this life out we call ourselves followers of Jesus, those of us that call ourselves followers of Jesus, how do we live this out, and what does it look like? What does this culture look like? And again, that I would agree with Dr. Stewart here, that the scariest thing, the greatest threat to Christianity is not something outside it, but how do we live inside it? And so keeping that in mind, we're going to jump into, again, Matthew 5, 13 through 16. And again, keeping in mind that Jesus has just talked about the persecution that his followers are going to face, right? He had just talked about, blessed are those who are persecuted, and blessed are those, who, you know, when people speak poorly about you or slander your name or all these different kinds of things that can happen to us. He says, blessed are you. And why is that important? And Jesus is going to explain why that's important for us to keep that in mind. And he says this. He says, you are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. And in the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. All right, we've all heard sermons from this. We've all heard Sunday school lessons or different things like that. So try not to go to sleep. I'm going to try to do my best to get this at a perspective that hopefully, and even if I don't, even if this is just a reminder sermon, those are wonderful to do and remind us to what is this purpose? What are we doing in this world and how we're moving forward? But Jesus uses two very common, in fact, two very essential elements. I talk about salt being such an essential part of how our bodies function and different things like that. Obviously, light being an essential part of being able to just work in this world, and especially as, you know, our natural light, the sun goes away, we have to have light to be able to continue to function and do things beyond that, especially like Shirley mentioned, as time changes and we get less light and all those things are happening. But Jesus also points out that it uses these in concert in such a way. We can't really separate these two images. They're both one and the same. And they're parallel, like almost poetic, the way they're parallel to Jesus uses them. And what he's saying when he first starts out both of these sermons, he's talking about the salt of the earth and the light of the world. And to me, that's just worth talking about by itself. If nothing else from this message, I think that that's an important part, because we get so caught up in not the earth and the world, but me and us and we. We don't think always about how is my words and my work and what I'm doing in my life impacting the rest of this world. But Jesus is very purposeful about this. He's not saying, be the salt of you. Be the salt of your family, or be the light of your little clique or your church or your community, because it's so easy to get focused on the people that are like us, that think like us, that are kind to us, that respond to us in certain ways. Jesus is very purposeful by saying it's not just about you. And especially for Jesus' time, he's speaking to the disciples who are all Jewish. All the people around them are Jewish. He's saying, get outside of that. This is something you are something for beyond those things. And so that's something that, again, Jesus starts out with that is so important for us to hold on to and move forward. But looking specifically at salt of the earth, Jesus goes on and he says, but if salt loses its saltiness, and that's where I'm going to kind of focus a little bit more. A lot of times you'll hear sermons about this and they'll talk about how salt's properties, it's preservative and, you know, tasty and, you know, gives spice or whatever. I'm going to focus on what Jesus focused on, and that's the taste. When salt is tasty, when it's added to something, it gives it something more than what it had before. In fact, I would say that there's a lot of food that is not edible without a certain amount of salt on it. I think most of us would probably agree if you try to eat, if you've been without salt. I really hope that I'm never forced not to eat salt. Actually, in fact, I don't think I would do that anyway. But it's one of those things where salt just enhances everything. It brings out the best in everything. And it's something that's very present and very understandable and knowable. And the reason that fits so well with Jesus' metaphor is because, again, it's something that's enhancing and bringing things out, but it's also such an important part as far as people can then experience it. And especially, like I just said, Jesus was just talking about being persecuted. What's our natural response when people insult us, or people put us down, or people, you know, maybe even physically harm us, as we see in Jesus' day, or even around the world today? What is our natural response? It's to not be salty. It's to not put ourselves out there. It's to not do anything to draw any attention to ourselves. In fact, that's probably more where I struggle with as far as persecution is intellectually. I, for a long time in my life, had a hard time sharing my faith or talking about my faith. It's a lot easier now because if people know I'm a pastor, but It was so hard because intellectually, I didn't want to get in arguments with people because I always felt kind of silly sometimes, right? You can't, I'm not getting into a theological debate scientific debate, but you know, science backs up so many things, and you talk and have these conversations. I always felt kind of silly, which is stupid because I know I'm right and it's whatever. But I always felt kind of self-conscious, I guess, about my faith, especially talking to someone who understands, the scientific background of different things and evolution and those kind of things. But anyway, I guess the point is it's our natural reaction to pull back. And Jesus says, that is not what I want you to do. I do not want you to pull back. I do not want you to hide inside doors. In fact, if we look at Jesus' disciples, they didn't hide. They should have hid, right? They would have been a lot more, themselves preserved, probably. But the gospel, the story, the truth wouldn't have gotten out there if they had hidden. But then Jesus continues on. He says, if that salt loses its saltiness, then what are we going to do? In fact, there's a rabbi, and this will take maybe a second for us to soak in. There's a rabbi in the late first century, about 90 AD, that was asked, how do you make salt salty again? And he says, you salt it with the afterbirth of a mule. All right, mules don't have babies. Anyway, so I'll just explain. That's easier that way. But He was joking, which strikes me as odd that a rabbi in the first century would joke. I know they had humor and stuff, but you're right. It's kind of the ask the stupid questions. You can't make salt salty again, and that's Jesus' point. That's very much Jesus' point. If it's salty, if salt loses its saltiness, it's worthless, and that's exactly what he says. In fact, he almost is saying it's a poison, I would say. In my yard, there's that brick driveway, which I love, or the brick sidewalk, which I love. I love that brick and the natural stuff there. It's such a pain to have to keep weeds out of it, though. And so for a long time, I tried to naturally do it. So I took vinegar and I took salt, and I mixed vinegar and salt and sprayed it onto the thing until my sprayer got clogged, and then I went to good, stronger killer stuff. And so it looks much better this year than it has ever. But that's the nature. Jesus, I think, is basically saying if it's not salty, we're going to throw it on the ground and kill weeds with it. It's going to be a poison for the weeds around, for the weeds on the ground, and it's basically worthless to us to consume. But that's Jesus' point, is that if we are followers of Jesus, there's no way that we can't be salty. Authentic and true followers of Jesus have to be stepping out and doing the things that he's asked us to do. And then he uses the imagery of the light. And again, we take light so much for granted, right? Even in our little rural community, if we shut all the lights off in our home, everything was off entirely. In fact, I guarantee, even if you shut all the lights off in your home, there's going to be little red lights or little green lights or something showing you little lights in something, right? Or even if you looked out, you have to put certain curtains and dark curtains on because we have lights here and there, and there's headlights. There's lights everywhere in our culture. And so we miss Jesus' metaphor just a little bit here, but if you just imagine this room completely dark, the way that they would light the room is they would put a candle on or a lantern or something on a stand right in the middle so it would light up the whole room. Most of them lived in single-room houses. And that was how they got their light. But we also know that the darker it is, the more that light stands out. So if you imagine, and just imagine yourself maybe here, and this is how I used it. I used my imagine us being in this church and how this looked. But Warren Hudson of Ontario, Canada, he said this. He said there was a special Saturday night service where a thunderstorm unleashed bolts of lightning that plunged the church into darkness. And so just like I would probably do too, and we would probably do, they decided they were going to just hand out candles. And so he felt his way to get candles and pass them out like a Christmas Eve service. And so they lit candles, they passed the flame around, and then they decided to check and go to the windows to see what was going on. And they could see people running for cover from the rain. They could see maybe traffic getting backed up and all these different things as the city plunged into darkness. And if you can imagine, a severe thunderstorm, there's absolutely no lights on, all the power is gone, and maybe some headlights flashing here and there. But the only light then ultimately we see in the whole area is if we took our candles and we took those little lights that we could hear, like a candlelight service, and we stepped outside these doors, all around us, for blocks, maybe even for farther than I can imagine, the only light would be emanating from the church. From us sitting out front. And if you can imagine that, and imagine that metaphor of this, or this image of just complete and utter darkness. And again, a storm seems to bring that darkness more than anything. And this light just shining, throughout the darkness. To me, that's the image that Jesus wants us to hold on to, is if everything around us is completely dark, and that little light, even if it was just one of us with one candle standing out front, it would be so visible to the world around us. Which is, again, exactly the image that Jesus wants us to have as we move forward through this as well. He says, though, as we shine our light, as we work through this, as we shine our light, he says, the things that we do, we don't hide under a basket, we show it to the world, again, the whole earth, the whole world. And he says, it should shine in such a way so that our good works will give glory. And for me, as I was reading and processing this, that really, really stuck out to me. Because I have a friend, and I've told you this a few times, I've been having some conversations with atheists, which would be a great book, I think, actually. And so maybe her and I will write it at some point. But we've had these conversations just to kind of figure out where we're at. And it helps me sharpen what I'm thinking and where I'm at. And I can have conversations with her and those kind of things. And she was telling me a story about how she was able to help out her neighbor in a unique way. And I told her, well, that's a very Christian thing to do. Those are fun things to say. And she's like, well, yes, sometimes atheists can be more moral than Christians. And I said, people that call themselves Christian, I said, that's very true. And so that's why this sticks out to me. How can someone who has no faith in God, no belief that there's a God, do things, and where does that glory go? And how do I go out and I do things, and not just doing things, Jesus uses good works, but have an attitude, have a presence, have a personality, live my life in such a way that God gets the glory, that the glory doesn't come to me. And I don't have practical application for you this morning. I think most of us can probably think of different things, but I struggle with that. How do I, and what I'm doing, represent not me, which I do think, you know, it's all right for people to thank me and like me because I do things for them. I'm all right with that. But how do they look past me and see God? And I think a lot of it, again, goes back to the Beatitudes, and it has to do with attitude. I think a lot of it has to do with my response. You know, if I say, well, thank you very much, you're welcome very much, I'm so glad that I could help you out and all those kinds of things. But there's so many, I think, little things that we can do. But I think just having that in our mind, that when we live our lives, when we go and do something, when we help somebody out, how does this point back to God? And again, the way that Jesus expresses that goes back to, again, another story that I read this week, another pastor that I read this week that actually was conversing. His name is Campbell Morgan. He's a Westminster. He's at Westminster Chapel in London. And he was sharing the story of two gentlemen, and one gentleman invited another gentleman that he had worked with for 5 years to come to church one time. Come to find out that as they have this conversation, they're actually both Christians. And so they thought it was pretty funny. They were coming telling their pastor, oh, this is funny. We're both Christians. We didn't know this for 5 years. And Morgan was really actually rather upset. He's like, how can you work together for 5 years and not know that you're both Christians? Unfortunately, that's a lot of ways our life falls into place, is that we don't either share our faith or we don't present things in a certain way. And again, how can an atheist, and it's not just our moral choices and the decisions that we make, but there's something more about who we are as followers of Jesus. But the last thing that Jesus, or one of the last things that Jesus says here is just one word that I want to point out. And it's the word Father. And I've talked about this before because I think it's such an important word that Jesus himself uses for God. But I think he purposely puts it here. This is the first time it shows up in the gospel that Jesus calls God Father. Because I just think it's important for us to know. It's so scary, I think, sometimes to think, well, I've got to be this salt. It's kind of like there's eyes on me all the time or people are staring, you know. We live in glass houses as Christians. People are watching my every move. I can't say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing. And so it can feel kind of scary to say, well, I'm going to be the salt of the earth or the light of the world. But Jesus says, when you do these things, you're not just going to give glory to yourself. You're going to give glory, or even just glory to God as some foreign, distant, uncaring being. But you are giving glory to your Father. And a Father, and I know some of us have better fathers than others, but a Father who is loving and caring and compassionate and involved in this world and involved in our lives. Like I said at the beginning, a God who wants to know each and one of our stories and wants to hear every single one of our thoughts and catch every one of our tears, as I've said before. But he's a father who's not just sending us out, oh, you know, like I do to the kids all the time, go outside, I don't want to deal with you, go outside. That's not what I say to him. It's usually what I'm thinking. But he's a God who is leading us out there, who is bringing us alongside, who is carrying us at times to do the things that he's asked us to do. He is compassionate and involved in our world and in our life, like a loving, benevolent God. And so when we go and we live this light, and we live this salt, and we go and we are these things, again, it's not so much doing as much as it is being, I would say. In fact, that's how Jesus words it. He doesn't say, be the light. He doesn't say, be the salt. He says, you are the salt. You are the light. And so as we live our lives and we are those things as followers of Jesus, we find a balance and we find a God, again, who is present and involved in what we're doing. But as we go, having all these things that the Beatitudes have told us and how we're going to look forward into the things that Jesus is going to a little more practically put into our laps here as we go through the rest of Matthew 5, there was an image that, again, I found this morning that I kind of want to close with. I'm going to close with this, basically. And it's this image of what salt looks like. Actually, I'm going to end with two images. The first one's the salt. And so the salt, I'm not a chemist, and so I'm taking this for somebody else's word. But basically, salt is sodium and chloride, right? It's combined together in a stable format for us to be able to be edible and those kind of things. But if we separate those two chemicals out, and this isn't Jesus' point at all because no one would have understood this back then, I think it provides us a neat image. And so we separate those two out and we look at sodium, and we look at the nature of sodium as a very stable, as a compound that usually attaches itself to others, other things, and chloride is basically the horrible smell that you get from bleach, the chlorine smell. And if we look at those as two different elements of our lives, and so we'll say the sodium is love. We'll say the sodium is grace. We'll say the sodium is compassion, right? Those things that we kind of think are hippie, I think of as hippie-ish. Some of you grew up hippie-ish, and so I shouldn't go too far there. Anyway, that love, mercy, grace kind of mentality. But then we maybe look at maybe some things that can be more offensive, like truth and justice, things that our world doesn't like to hear about. And so if we take those two things of love and grace and mercy, too much of that can be fluffy, can be meaningless. It can just be about, well, how am I feeling, or what is, all these kind of good things at times, but it doesn't have any root, it doesn't have any foundation. But again, too often truth and justice, things that we hold on to that can be cold and callous, it can be judgmental and rude. And so finding a way to bring those two together, to find a way to with truth and justice as our foundation, to go forward in love and mercy and grace and compassion. Jesus, again, this wasn't his point. This is, I just think, a powerful image for us to hold on to, that when we are the salt, when we are that sodium and chloride put together, we balance out what love, truth, or love and grace and mercy and truth and justice look like together. And then when we look at the light, there's another image of a young man, and he goes to a cathedral that has these beautiful stained glass windows with his mother, and they're walking around and they're seeing the light shine in through these windows, and the little boy asks his mother, well, who are these people? Who are these images of in the windows? And the mother looks at him and she looks at the pictures and she says, oh, well, those are saints, the saints of old and people that they're honoring in the windows and those kind of things. And the little boy said, well, then I know what saints are. Saints are the ones that let light shine through them. And to me, again, that's another powerful image, for as we live as salt or light in this world, are we allowing Jesus, who is the light of this world, shine through us in a unique and a powerful way as well? And so as we close, as we wrap it up this morning, what does that look like? What does that look like for us and for you and for our world? And I don't know. I'd love to talk to you. If you want to come talk to me sometime, we can't meet in my office anymore, but I would love to talk to you and we can figure out something. But it's the day-to-day stuff. It's the practical things that we live out on a day-to-day basis. How do we live out that love and grace and mercy with that truth and justice that Jesus taught us? And how do we practically live that out in an attitude, in a way, in a day-to-day life? My hope is, if nothing else, that instead of focusing just on our those close to us, just those that think like us and look like us and act like us, instead of looking at just maybe a small circle or a little clique of people, that we start to look a little bit beyond these walls, that we look a little bit beyond our normal influence, area of influence, and we reach out and we say, I'm going to find a way to give God the glory through my actions, through my attitudes, and through who I am. Let's pray. Gracious Father, you call us to such an amazing act, an amazing attitude, an amazing place to be salt and to be light. And Lord, I know it can be heavy. I know it can be hard. I know it can be kind of scary and even overwhelming at times, Lord. But I just pray that we take a little step, like we talked about last week, a little step. A step here and a step there can help lead us down to a path where it looks significantly different in a year or 5 years. And Lord, I just pray that we can know that when we are even just walking down the street, driving across town, that we're talking to someone at the store, or we're thinking about what can I do and making a call or you know, handing out something to help a family or whatever. Lord, I just pray that we know that this is for you, and it is to honor and to glorify our Father who is in heaven. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.